My name is Tammy, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Ed and Rebecca, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Antoinette will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Antoinette, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Zach will read the steps.
I'm Zach, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character. Step 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Step 8, made a list of all persons we have harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the results of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Peggy will read the traditions.
Thank you. My name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. 12 Traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be anonymous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Number six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Number eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Number 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Number 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. Number 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And number 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Arian.
Hi, my name's Arian. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 3rd, 2004. My home group is the Atlantic Group. I'm involved in sponsorship. I have sponsees. My sponsor, Giroux, has a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I have a service commitment, and I'm very, very grateful to the Atlantic Group for asking me to come share my experience, strength, and hope tonight. If you're new and you are asking yourself whether or not you belong here, that's okay. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't think... Thank you. I didn't think that I belonged here at all. So my suggestion to you is to tell somebody what you're thinking, preferably somebody who seems to have what you want. Maybe they have a peace or a calm about them. Maybe they have a smile on their face. Ask them, tell them what you're thinking and ask them for help. It's not what I did when I first got here. My mother is an alcoholic, and she's in and out of the rooms. And I say that just because I was very fortunate that she introduced me to the program at a very young age. I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 16. I had spent the greater part of those 16 years building up a very important foundation. For me, I identified myself by the things that I had accomplished. So I was an honor student. I was an athlete. I was involved in activities. I did things with my temple, and I like to think that I was a pretty good son. And in January of 2001, I had been working to get into a great school, and I took my SATs, and that was just one more feather in my cap. And at that point, I got the scores I wanted, and I realized that I could just coast on by. I had taken a drink, I'm sure, at some point growing up. I don't specifically remember my first drink. I do remember when I made the conscious or unconscious decision in January of 2001 that now I could drink. Now it was my time. You know, I had done everything that I was supposed to do, and now I could drink the way I wanted to drink. So very quickly, the fair weather friends I had, and I say that because I was involved in so many activities and I kept everyone at bay. I was very much a manipulator without even realizing it. And I would tell you what I thought you wanted to hear, and I would be your friend to the extent that you had something to offer me. And at 16, I had achieved everything I felt was worthwhile in life, and now it was time to become a man, to go drink. And that lasted 3 years. I very quickly drank away the accomplishments that I had worked so hard for. I drank away the trust. I drank away the friendships. I drank away any kind of feeling I had inside of me that I was still a good guy, you know, because that was what I was telling myself for a very long time. I'm a good guy. I just stole your wallet, but I helped you look for it. I'm, you know, I'm a good guy because I, you know, I'm the one that tries to gather together all the money to go buy the keg of beer or the whatever it was. What I wasn't telling you was I was making a nice little profit and drinking for free. You could say, you know, I rationalize this by saying, well, I was doing a service for you, and so I'm entitled to get paid. And, you know, and it was things like that. I was so dishonest. Not necessarily acts of commission, some acts of omission. The fact was that my father instilled in me at a very young age, he said, anything that comes out of my mouth, anytime I promise you something, you can believe it. And today, it's true. When he tells me something, I have no doubt. The same cannot be said for me. I would often lie, even if it was the, you know, not necessarily a situation where you would want to lie, you know. The truth could be, you know, completely benign, but I would lie because I wanted to build things up. I wanted to be grandiose. So as I said, I picked up a drink at 16, January of 2001. I graduated high school. Again, I really thought I had everybody fooled. I kept the grades up just enough. I stayed involved just enough. I did just enough. And I went away to college, and I had arrived, as Bill says, and I can identify with that. I got to college, and at this point, you know, all bets were off. I joined the swim team, which let me drink the way I wanted to drink, and I spent the next year and a half trying to both control and enjoy my drinking, which were very, very difficult things to do. When it was time to get up to go to the 8 a.m. chem lab on a Friday morning, I was incapable of doing so. But if you asked me to go out on Thursday night and have a beer with a friend's father, I was capable of doing that, but I couldn't enjoy it. If I wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink on Thursday night, there was no way I was getting up for class the next morning. And if I wanted to, you know, put on airs the night before, what's the point? And I drank very heavily for a year and a half, and very quickly the little things that I had managed to form in that community up there, I lost again. I was swimming for my university. I lost that. I lost both jobs. And there were very four incidents in quick succession where the university explained to me that if I continue to behave the way I've been behaving, they're going to ask me to leave. I found out later that normal people, when faced with consequences, stop. I couldn't. It's not that I didn't want to. It's that I thought I could beat the system. It's not I thought I could manipulate. It was the same things that had been happening years before were now right there in front of me. And I was asked to leave that university that I had spent those 16 years building up, and now I moved back home with my parents, which was, to me, was demoralizing. And I still thought I was right. I still thought I was justified. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. I'm too smart. I'm too this. I'm too that. And the list went on and on and on, and I went, as part of my condition to get back into the school, I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And for whatever reason, I arrived at that meeting. They asked if anybody was new, and you hear about, you know, that moment of clarity, honesty, whatever it was, and I put my hand up, and I said I was new, and I asked for help. And I was very fortunate that there were a lot of people there that that had been sober for some time, and they quickly approached me, and they encouraged me to get a sponsor and get a service commitment, and I did coffee for 6 months. I told them that I knew how to make coffee, and I had no idea how to make coffee. But I was, I was so concerned about what you thought of me, yet I still thought I was better than you, and it was sort of that battle. But I kept coming back, and I would buy Dunkin' Donuts coffee and pour it in, and you must have known because it was good coffee. But I kept showing up, and at 3 months sober, my sponsor picked me up late on a Friday night. We drove down to Baltimore. We arrived at a young person's convention, and for the first time, I saw hope. I was 19 years old, I thought my life was over, and I saw young people dancing, having a great time, complete insanity, and I loved it. And it kept me coming back, which I did. And I continued to sort of travel the country going to conventions, and I was very active in my home group, and I was doing service. But I wasn't working the steps. And at 10 months, I hit a spiritual bottom in sobriety that drove me into the arms of a sponsor who had a solution, and he began taking me through the big book. I went back to the school that I got kicked out of, and as a result, my work with that particular sponsor was interrupted. And I was fortunate enough to get a home group there, but I wasn't working the steps. I moved twice more before finally coming to New York and finding the Atlantic Group, which my higher power brought me here, and it's a very curious story, which I can tell you about another time. But I was introduced to my sponsor today, who asked me to do a number of things. He asked me to call him every day, make a meeting every day, pray every day, you know, home group, service commitment, all the things I mentioned in the beginning that were very, very important. And he began taking me through the steps as they're laid out in the big book. And I got to tell you, I have had an amazing ride. I got engaged this year. I've traveled internationally. I've traveled to many, many places, non-English speaking places, and found Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I've been able to share my experience with other people, and I've been able to regain that trust and the honesty that I never had. I have today. You know, you can rely absolutely on the things I say. I haven't told a lie since I've been up here. And that's amazing for 10 minutes. So if you're new and you're wondering, am I an alcoholic? Do I belong here? You know, why are all these people so happy? There is a solution. You can find it here. You just have to be willing to put up your hand, ask for help. And I'm sure someone, would be happy to help you. So thank you very much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Hannah.
Okay, this is happening. I am Hannah. I'm an alcoholic. I can't believe this is happening because when I came in here, I was literally mute. I'm really scared right now, but I was so scared of people, and, I was obsessed with myself, and, I lived in a very painful place of just complete self-centeredness, and, I came here when I was counting days, but I never stood up to count days, never. I would go to the beginner's meeting, and I would count the rows to see, like, from which direction I would get hit, you know, like, who I would be next to. And Debbie actually asked me to read from page 86 on the meditation meeting, and I said no. Like, I couldn't do it, and Debbie asked me to speak today, so it's really, I've come a long way, actually. So I grew up in Manhattan to two non-alcoholic parents. I have two younger sisters who both, I think, drink normally. I had a really happy childhood. I drank when I was 14, and it was, I blacked out the first time I drank, but it wasn't weird to anyone around me because they all drank sort of the way I drank. I wasn't that, blown away. Some people talk about, like, they had this spiritual experience the first time they drank, and it was pretty great, and I continued to drink from them, but it wasn't like, I didn't feel that sense of relief that some people talk about. But somehow it was, I knew to drink when I felt really bad. I drank all through high school with some consequences. I am 22, and I've been to 4 ERs and have been 2 ambulances and a psych ward, and those are just some consequences, but all of that stuff isn't really what make me alcoholic, I don't think. What really makes me bodily and mentally different from my fellows is my reaction to alcohol and the fact that when I drink, I cannot stop drinking. And I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea, and it's always different, and it's always a nightmare. And then when I'm not drinking, I think about either when I'm going to start drinking or how I'm going to not start drinking. So either way, I'm obsessed. And when I was 17, that was kind of not normal. Even though I was, drinking with people, they didn't have the same reaction. They didn't plot out their drinks. They didn't, keep tally marks on their hand or, that, like, went off towards the end. And then So, yeah, it was just really painful. I went to college thinking, like, great, like, everybody's going to be drinking like me. Like, this is going to be so cool. And no one was, and they were really kind of off-put by the way I drank. And I was sort of just like, Boston is so uncool. And so I left after 2 years. And that's when I started like drinking by myself and, you know, that. And I never thought that I was self-centered, or that this, you know, my alcoholism affected other people, because I thought I was really nice. And, you know, I had done a lot of community service, and I thought like that made me, non-alcoholic and not self-centered, because I just did things for me, you know, but I came here and I realized like that is the problem. And, that was the problem. And, I don't know. So I had a really good friend that I drank a lot with, and he had gotten sober, and I saw his life change totally. I mean, it was like insane. And I was having a really hard time. I knew to stop drinking because things were pretty unmanageable in my life. Well, unbearable, really. And so I started counting days on my own before I had even gone to a meeting. And I was really, really miserable by like day 30. Because as I've learned here, the drinking was really just a symptom of a much larger problem, which is the alcoholism. And so I was, you know, hysterically crying in the middle of the day. And I called my friend who was sober, not because he was sober, just because I really had no one else to talk to. And he was like, hold on, I'm going to have my friend who's going through something similar call you. And it was Ashley, who's here. And she called me and I answered and she took me to my first meeting. And, you know, I've been pretty involved ever since. You know, for like the first 9 months, I was a little bit reluctant to commit absolutely because I was sort of like, well, I'm young and I have like a social life, which I didn't. And I had some trouble showing up at first, but I really do make AA a priority in my life today. I show up when I'm asked and I do a lot of service here. And that's the stuff that makes me, you know, happy. And you know, that's not the point, really. My sponsor, Rebecca, is always like I've called crying and she said, my purpose isn't to make you feel good. It's to make you happily and usefully whole. And that's what I get from AA. I feel 1,000 times better, but really I'm useful today. I do stuff today. And I, you know, I have friends that reach out to me today, which is like, blows my mind, really. And, you know, they call me when they're having problems, which is, I can't even tell you, it's crazy. And, you know, it used to be me, always. Like, what did I do? And, you know, just making a real mess of things. And I get to show up for the people that matter today. And there are a lot more people that matter. I call my sponsor every day. I have been through she's taken me through the 12 steps. And all those places that I never was able to show up, even in AA today, I get to show up, you know, where at the meeting I met my sponsor at, the Step in Tradition meeting, I now have the privilege of leading. I used to go to the Big Book meeting and pass. And I have gotten to lead circles there, and it's like really changed my sobriety. And it's just really, what's the time looking like? Okay. It's going fast, but not that fast. And, I don't know, this is like a really exciting place for me. I get to grow up sober, and I feel really lucky to do that. everything I've learned that I get to apply outside of here, I've learned in AA. You know, how to meet people, how to show up for people, how to be of service. Those are all principles I learned in AA, and that's what makes me a functioning human outside of these rooms. And I feel, I can't even tell you, you know, my mother, she's like, I'm so impressed by you, and she doesn't know it's because I go to meetings 5 days a week or because I do assignments for my sponsor or I call other alcoholics, but she sees that I apply these principles in all my affairs. And if you're new, this is a design for living that really works. You get to learn how to live here. And it's really fun. I love AA, and I love all the things we get to do here. So, thanks.
Our main speaker tonight is Howard.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, can I get a little more drums in the monitor? Thank you. I'm Howard. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really, I'm very, very grateful to be here. And thank you very much, Heidi, for asking me to speak. And I had the pleasure of doing service with Heidi at the Manhattan County for the past couple of years, and we would sit there in these meetings and text each other like, what's going on? I don't know. I thought you knew what was going on. And so it's been really great getting to know her, but there's a lot of people in this room that I love and that are very, very close to my heart. And I was actually bummed Stacy's not going to be here tonight because he's very dear to me. And so, Stacy, if you're listening to this tape, tell Rufus I said hello. Exactly. So I just wanted to, you know, the thing that I was thinking about is speaking in a church is very interesting because I got drunk the first time in a church. And my mom's very religious. She's a priest, actually. And so she would drag us to church, and you know, and it was bananas at home. It was crazy, and it was nutty. And so I think she kind of took solace in coming and being a part of this thing. But it meant that I had the run of the place with some friends, and I also had keys to rooms that I probably shouldn't have had keys to, and or at least knew where the keys were on her keychain. And we stole this box of wine that, you know, with the magic inflatable bag inside with the rubber nozzle. And I don't know, I must have been like 11, 10, and actually probably 10. And me and my friend went down into the basement, and the way that we drank this wine is just, this is the story of my drinking. One of us was the lookout. The other one of us poured as much wine as we could into this little glass and just slammed it, just as much as we could get back. And we got totally sick, and it was great. And no one ever told me to drink like that. I never saw anyone drink like that. But instinctively, that's how I drink. End of story. The end. Like, that's my drinking. And regardless of what was going on at home, and there was a lot going on at home, but regardless of what was going on at home, regardless of what was going on at school, as long as I can remember, I felt this deep sense of I don't know how you describe it. At the same time, I'm better than you, but at the same time, you know, you don't get me and I'm getting the short end of the stick. And I think for a long time, I really believed that I was part of some alien experiment. And any time they would come down and, you know, beam me up and say, oh, it was all a joke. None of these people really did understand you because you're actually different. And I think that the drinking was a solution to that. When I drank, I felt relief. When I drank, I felt better. When I drank, I felt like I could be funny. When I drank, I felt like I could relate to you, like I could talk to you, and suddenly I had a place in the world. And very quickly, within a couple of years of starting to drink, it was all that I did. It was all that I focused on. It was all that I ever thought about. And it worked. It really worked, which is foreshadowing to another it really worked thing. But the thing that was wonderful was that I had some way to curb what I was feeling. You know, I had some way to dampen down the emotion, to dampen down the fear. And, you know, left to my own devices, it's really the only solution that I could come up with was to get really stinking drunk. And I did it a lot. And so within a couple of years, I was, you know, drinking every day. I wasn't the kind of person that was able to maintain a 9-to-5 job or stay in school or whatever. You know, I was a teenager. And it got really messy. It got really messy really quickly. And me and friends would, you know, we would do everything from, you know, steal motorcycles and, you know, grind the serial numbers off and make fake titles and sell them to people as restored vehicles. And that really works too. And we would do whatever we had to. We stole from people. We stole from houses. We robbed each other. We were constantly fighting. And, you know, and that's the kind of thing that goes along with my drinking. You know, I don't have people that I can trust when I'm drinking. I don't have people that I can turn to when I'm drinking. I don't have people that have my best interests in mind around me. In fact, I make pretty much categorically, 100% of the time, bad decisions when I'm drinking. And for a long time, I was willing to take those bad decisions for the relief that I got for being drunk. And that relief in the beginning was a pretty big window of relief. In the beginning it was, I just felt better. And there were big windows of time, you know, maybe even an hour, that I would feel relief. But then as my drinking progressed, it got less and it got less and it got shorter and shorter and the consequences got more and more and more. And, you know, and I started to not be able to go to school. You know, and so my solution was, I'm just going to not go to school. I'm going to drop out. And I started to get in trouble at home. So I stopped staying at home. I stopped living with my parents. I started to get in trouble with the law, and then it really culminated when I was back staying with my parents one night, and they I woke up one morning and there was a cop, the priest from my mom's church, my mom, my dad, and you know, my sister and one of her friends, and they were sitting there, and they had a bunch of stuff on the table, dining room table, things that I shouldn't have had, and evidence they liked to call it, and you know, and I'm sitting there in a bathrobe, you know, like spiked hair, like hating all of them, twitching, and they said, we don't think you're a bad person. We don't think the problem is that you're a bad person. We don't think you're a criminal, although you clearly do criminal things. We think the problem is that you're an alcoholic. We think the problem is that you have a disease. And the good news is that there's a cure for this disease. There's a solution. And we want to provide you an opportunity to do something about that. And so, here I am, I'm being presented with this choice, and they're telling me that I have either the ability to do something about a problem that I have, that, you know, in my head, they say that I have, or I have the choice to go to DC jail with X counts of felony, and these charges would stand. But they've already talked to, you know, the authorities. They're going to clear it out. All I got to do is go to this program and complete it, continue it, stay sober, and there's no charges. Sounds great, right? Sounds like an opportunity. So one of the things that the steps and the literature talks about is the idea of alcoholism as a form of insanity. You know, so my big, like, case study definition of insanity for me in my life is that in that moment, that's what they said to me. They said, you can go to jail or you can get help and you can acknowledge you're a problem, you have a problem. And what went through my head was, I'd rather go to jail. I'd rather go to jail. Because I knew people that were in the jail at the time. I knew they were drinking. something with ketchup and the something, I don't know, like, anyway. They would smuggle stuff in, and that is exactly what went through my head. I know I can find the kind of relief that I want if I continue to make the choice. And the insanity in that moment is that I believed that my choices were still gonna work. And, you know, you can't tell an alcoholic that their choices aren't going to work anymore unless they're ready to hear it, you know? And that's why this is a program of attraction and not promotion. You know, nothing that I can say, nothing that was said to me before I was ready to hear it stuck. Nothing. Nothing. You know? And so anyway, they said, too bad, you're going to rehab. And and they shipped me off to this place in Maryland, and I... you know, and I'm from D.C., and D.C., and Baltimore, we kind of got this thing, we don't like each other, and so, you know, you got these, I'm this punk rock kid from D.C., and you got these kids from Baltimore with mullets, and they drive T-Birds, and they listen to heavy metal, and it's just not my scene, and the girl put the cat in the microwave, and that's not me, I don't know what she's talking about. You know, and, but one of the things that, that they said was, well, they had to sit in meetings, and they had people bring in meetings to this place, And I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I don't want to have anything to do with it. My dad was sober. You know, I'd been told that there was alcoholism in my family, that it was a disease. I had been told that I was probably an alcoholic. And what I started to do is I started to adopt their language to get them off of my back, right? And I started to learn the words, you know, and I started to say, oh, I've got a problem. I can admit that. I can acknowledge that. And I started to redefine the words and the language that you hear in here. I started to redefine it for myself in a way that felt a lot better, right? So I could admit that I couldn't drink safely, which just means like, watch out world, I'm unsafe, you know? Like I can admit I'm an alcoholic in the like romantic Bukowski or, you know, Sid and Nancy kind of way. Like I get that. I can relate to that. I can handle that. If I take a drink, I'm gonna get drunk. Okay, all right, great. So I'm just not gonna plan anything for the next 2 weeks after that. No problem. You know, like, oh, you gotta surrender. Oh, I totally surrender. Like, when's lunch again? You know, and there was none of the desperation that's the predicate for this stuff really working. You know, the first line of the first step in the 12 and 12 is, who cares to admit complete defeat? And there's a difference between complete defeat and crying uncle. You know, and at that moment, like, I cried uncle. I was like, get off my back. I don't, you know, like, sure, I'll write an inventory. I hate you. I hate him. I hate... That's all I was capable of doing. That's the only thing I was capable of doing at the time. But, you know, and I got out of that place, I completed the program, and I had a head full of the language, and I was back on the spot within 30 seconds drinking. And, but, you know, the thing that they say in the literature, once you tell an alcoholic the true nature of their malady, they're forever changed. So here I am, I'm a teenager, and I got a head full of the literature, you know, and I'm willing to use that against you, use that to deflect. And at the same time, I'm trying to convince myself that I can handle it. That I can handle it, right? Okay, so I can believe I'm an alcoholic. I get the first, like, you know, quarter of the first step. And I believe that if I take a drink, that I'm going to have a physical, mental, spiritual, physiological reaction to it. I believe that. But I also believe that I can control it. I believe I can manage the problem. And I spent a bunch of years trying to manage that problem. You know, and I did all the stuff that they talked about in the literature and all the ways that I thought I was different and all the things that didn't apply to me because my circumstances were totally different from any of you. You guys can't relate to me at all. I did all those things, you know, like solemn oaths, you know, like drinking just clear liquid. Somehow, some reason I got into my head that the color of the liquid was associated with it. So I tried the different shades of whiskey. like, and it was, if it was a lighter color whiskey, it was better. I mean, like, I would come up with these totally cockamamie things. I remember I had this thing with taxis. And that if I saw a certain amount of taxis on the street within a certain period of time, it meant it was okay to drink. And I would just come up with these cockamamie formulas that would constantly change so that it ended with, it was okay for me to drink. And I would change it halfway through. And what happened to me, though, was you know, the biggest drama was behind me. The biggest drama was behind me, but I still had years of drinking to do. But what happened was I started to collapse. The whole it worked part, well, it stopped working, right? It stopped working. It stopped relieving me. It stopped making me feel better. When I would be drunk, I would find myself in a situation where I didn't mean to be drunk, suddenly I'd be drunk, and I would just get that, man, I didn't mean to be drunk again. I didn't want to be drunk again. But I can't turn it off. I can't stop it. So all I can do is just try to get more drunk, but then that doesn't work. You know, and then the moments where I thought I could just have one and be okay, yeah, suddenly I'm hammered. You know, and the moments where I'm trying to, you know, keep it together, I can't get drunk. You know, and in the end, it was me horribly alone, horribly isolated, so full of self-hatred. Just the amount of isolation from myself and spiritual isolation, like I can taste that. I can still taste that. You know, and in the end, it was me drunk on whiskey, screaming at an ex, I don't even know what about. And I just had this moment where I saw myself. It was almost like an out-of-body experience. I saw myself screaming at this girl. And there was a little voice in my head that said, if you keep drinking, it's going to be like this for the rest of your life. And the next thing that went through my head was, if this is what life is like, I don't want to be alive. I don't want to be alive. I don't want to live like that. And I think that, to me, was the first real moment of desperation that I had. I can't live like this. I can't feel like this. I can't have these feelings of isolation anymore and continue to walk around and talk and pretend to be, you know, like an autonomous meat bot. Like, hello, how are you doing? I'm coming to work today. Like, I can't do that anymore. You know? And somehow I ended up starting to go to meetings. Like, I don't know. I don't know how that happened. I don't know how that happened. And I didn't come in. I wasn't lucid. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't able to talk. I wasn't able to really participate. Like, I could still recite the words, you know, but I wasn't here. I wasn't here. And, you know, and people said the craziest things to me when I came into AA. They told me to set up chairs and do coffee and go talk to that guy in the corner and come out to the diner with us. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, what does that have to do with me? You know? And I gotta say, in the beginning, I didn't do those things. I just couldn't do it. I was so angry. And I was telling someone the other day, I don't even remember the names of the guys that I got sober with. I don't remember my first sponsor's name. I don't remember his name. I had to look up after the fact what my anniversary date was. Like, that's how messy I was in my head. And, you know, and I changed everything right away, you know, like I moved cities and I dropped out of school and, you know, and the crazy. And you know, after a little bit of time, like what happens with us, you know, you clear up a little bit, the cops stop chasing you, you know, like you're able to flinagle your way into a lease and but the other thing that happened was, you know, like one of the things it talks about in literature is you know, people jump into work. They jump into something that they're focused on, right? You know, and I jumped into work. And it happened to coincide with, you know, something I was really good at. There was a big market for it. And so within a couple of years, I was making a lot of money. And I used the money and the rewards and the pats on the back as evidence for how well I was doing. and my involvement with a spiritual solution that was nascent at best became less and less and smaller and smaller, you know, and it culminated for me, you know, I had a few years sober, and I'd moved up to New York. I got sober in D.C. I moved up to New York, and I didn't go to any meetings. I didn't call anybody, and there was a period in my life where I didn't know anyone in AA. I didn't have anybody's phone numbers. I didn't go to any meetings. And I had 1,000 problems. I had 100,000 problems. And the world was closing in on me. And it really culminated for me this moment. I was dating a girl. She was Irish. Her family lived in Liverpool. I went to Christmas with her in Liverpool. And it was like her and her small family and 3 cases of wine and 2 days. And I felt like so isolated and so walled off. And that self-hatred that I had when I was last drinking was there again, and I felt that again, you know, and I taste that again. And I remember sitting there thinking, the reason why you don't connect with these people is because they're drinking and you're not. The only difference between you and them is that they're drinking and you're not. So you're just torturing yourself. Why don't you just drink? Why aren't you drinking? You know, and the story should be, in all rights, the story should be, and I drank, and it got worse. I don't know why I didn't drink. I have no idea. I have no idea, but I can tell you one thing, which is up until that point, I used to say things like, you have no idea what I pulled myself out of, and let me tell you about what it was like for me back then, and here's how strong I am, and here's what I used to be like, and here's what I'm like now, and like, that means I'm like totally cool. But something carried me through that moment. And the humbling thing was that I realized it wasn't me. That I realized that I couldn't keep myself sober, I couldn't get myself sober. And that the power in my own head was going to wind me up drunk again. And the power in my own head and the decisions that I make bring me back to that place of complete incomprehensible demoralization that they talk about in the literature. And I was at that point again where I was like, if life is going to be like this, I don't want to be alive. And I was literally on my way to jump off of the promenade onto the BQE in Brooklyn Heights, and somehow I wound up at midnight. I don't know how. And that's a higher power working in my life. You know, and it's like, and I love you, and I love this meeting, but I could not go to meetings where people looked good and smelled nice. I had to go to the meetings where people slept on the chairs and threw things, and I felt comfortable with that because that's how I felt on the inside. And there's a reason that places like that exist, and they do a lot of service, and they do as much service as places like this. And I did the thing that they said to do in my first year, and I set up chairs, and I made coffee. And I took a literature commitment, and I went to like 3 meetings a day, you know, and because I felt it, and I finally had that second part of the first step, you know, and I finally know what it's like to say, my way doesn't work drunk or sober, and I need a solution both ways, or I'm going to wind up drunk again, and if I drink again, I'm going to kill myself because I just can't live like that. You know, and the AA formula that I've witnessed and that I've read in all the literature is very simple. It's that if you believe that I have what you have, if you believe that I suffered as much as you're suffering, and you believe that I'm better, then what works for me is going to work for you too. It's as simple as that. You know, and what I found were people, you know, like Kevin O and Eddie Hatz and Freddie the Rock and Roll Butcher. You know, and these guys that were like messy, crazy people, but that lived this thing every day. And they held my hand and they showed me how to do this thing. You know? And I met my sponsor, my current sponsor, you know, he was speaking on the 12th step, and the thing that ran through my head was, I need to learn how to be useful. Those weren't the words that I used, but I need to learn how to be of service because I had no idea. And I heard this guy talking, and it was the first time I had ever heard someone and said, that guy has what I want. And it wasn't about money, and it wasn't about esteem or status. It was about, that guy knows how to be of service to other people, and I need a mentor because I have no idea how to be of service to other people. Zero. You know, and I talked to him, and he said, come to my home group, you know, come to my home group next week, and we'll talk. And I showed up at the home group, and I was like, oh, what's up? Remember me? He's like, yeah, come back next week. So I came back the next week, and I was like, yo, you remember me? Remember me? Yeah, come back next week. And he did that for like 4 or 5 weeks. And it was great, because he wanted to see that I was serious. And I'm not saying that's what you should do with everybody, but I'm just saying that's what he did with me. But it was good, because all my life I had been full of it just to try to get over. You know, and here I am wanting to do it the right way, and it feels so awkward and it feels so unnatural. But that's what happens. Once we strip away the alcoholic mess, yeah, it's hard. It's awkward. But what's on the other side is peace. What's on the other side is coming up and speaking at a meeting that I don't go to and having 50 friends come up to hear me speak. That's amazing. Being loved enough that people call me and ask me for help. Knowing how to be useful, knowing how to be of service to people, like, and I'm not saying that I call this up out of my head, that I know this stuff instinctively, because I don't, but AA has provided a structure for me that gives me ways to be useful to people. Like, I know how to walk into a room and talk to people that feel uncomfortable because I do it every week at my home group with newcomers. I know how to do that. Let's be useful, so I can take that into work. I can take that into society. I don't know how to be useful on my own. AA's given me 1,000 different ways to do it, from making coffee at my meeting, to talking to new people, to talking to people on the phone, to getting involved in general service, to being a DCM, to whatever. But I now have this repertoire of ways to be useful that didn't come from me. But it starts with me showing up. It starts with me participating on a daily basis. It starts with me being willing to change what I do, to get to the meeting early, to sit in the same seat. So when that guy comes back 6 months from now, he says, oh, I remember you, because all he can remember is where I was sitting. That's how I was. You know? And the people that I know that do the most service, they sit in the same seat every week. And they are there hours before the meeting starts, and they are always available. And I aspire to that. That's really hard. It's very difficult, you know. I am a member of AA. I have a home group. I love my home group. My home group goes away, I'm going to get another home group. I love this program, but it started with me loving my meeting, which is right. That makes sense, right? Because I can't think about the fellowship as this big abstract concept. You know, it was really hard for me to relate to at first. I got kind of too much thrown at me at once in the beginning. But I started to care about my group, and so I started to want to show up. I started to want to make coffee. I started to want to set up chairs. And then suddenly it was like, gee, where do we get our literature from? Or gee, how do new people find out about this meeting? And so I started to get involved in intergroup or buying literature or taking commitments. And then, gee, well, how does it work in other places? You know, how do we make sure that my teenage cousin, who may or may not be an alcoholic, the AA is around for that person 15, 20 years from now? So I started to get involved in general service. And I started to care about this fellowship. And I started to care about the spiritual solution that we have, which is amazing. And it's precious. You know? And it's definitely something that can be extinguished unless we continue to feed it. You know, and so it's like when you hear people say, show up and go to meetings and get a sponsor and get a service position, it's about your spiritual condition. It's about how to keep from drinking. It's about how to have a healthy life. But it's also about how to help that next alcoholic and how to make sure AA sticks around so that it continues to be there in future generations. And it's a big deal. It's a big deal, you know, the thing that I love about meetings like this and about PAX and about Alive Again and the 79th Street Workshop and, you know, the West Side Club in D.C. and, you know, all these places is that they are magnets for people who need hope. I need hope. I need hope. I'm an alcoholic. And without you, without this fellowship, without a relationship to a higher power that I get through my relationship with you, I have no hope. Because when I wake up in the morning, I just got all this stuff rattling around in my head. And my instinct is not to do things like be useful, is not to get out of my own skin. It's not to find a spiritual solution. I want to fix it. I want to feel better. I want it to go away. But I just can't do that by myself. And it's taken me a long time to realize I can't do anything in my own skull to make it better. I have to go outside of it. And that's you, and that's the literature, and it's God, and it's the fellowship, and it's rejoining this world. So thank you very much.